Hey there, welcome to the Creative Classroom Podcast. I'm your host, John Spencer. I'm a former middle school teacher, current college professor, and I am passionate about seeing teachers transform their classrooms into bastions of creativity and wonder. And that's pretty much what we do in this podcast. We explore what it means to make that happen. So, we all know that kids learn at a deeper level when they do meaningful projects. If you're listening to this podcast, chances are you are most likely a fan of PBL. And you might be someone who is using it on a regular basis, and so what I'm sharing might not be new at all to you. This might be kind of like a well, duh, we get this already kind of podcast. But you also might be someone who is thinking about it, who has heard of PBL, but you're not quite sure if you're ready to make a jump. Or maybe you've tried it out a little bit and you've had mixed results and you're curious about what it means to make project-based learning happen. That's what this podcast is all about. I want to be real for a second. PBL can feel daunting at first. How do you make it fit within the standards? How do you find the time for it? How do you make sure every student participates? If you're curious about PBL, but you're terrified about making that first jump, I totally get it. I've been there before. In fact, I believed in 7 huge lies that prevented me from even trying PBL with my students. And in this particular podcast, we are going to explore those lies that teachers believe that keep them away from project-based learning. But first, I want to share a personal experience. The most epic project that I ever did when I was a kid. And the idea is this, that my most memorable learning experience wasn't a worksheet. It was when I was in the 8th grade. I was a combination of shy and nerdy, and my whole goal was to remain invisible. I had one friend, this kid named Matt, and we were 2 nerds in a pod. And fortunately for me, he had perfect attendance year after year. But then one day he was sick, and I stood there in the cafeteria looking out at the sea of students, hoping someone would invite me in and ask me to be part of their group at their table. But it didn't happen. I hid out in the boys' restroom for the next 24 minutes. And the thing is, I was invisible. My plan of being invisible had worked. I was invisible. But not to Mrs. Smoot or to Mr. Darrow. See, they knew me. They knew I cared about social justice and baseball and history, and so they invited me to be a part of the History Day project. Although it was fun, it was also terrifying. I had to plan out the entire project and track my own progress. I had to figure out what questions to ask and where to find the answers. I had to narrow down the topic to something that I cared about, in this case, Jackie Robinson and the integration of baseball. I wrote letters to newscasters and made phone calls to former players. I remember picking up the phone, my hands trembling, as I read this pre-recorded script and waited for the stranger to respond. I eventually worked on this slide presentation, and although it was difficult, it was also exhilarating, and it was fun. The most nerve-wracking part came when I sat in this radio studio and I recorded my script on this big magnetic tape. And then I heard my voice for the first time and I said to my teacher, "I am done. I'm not doing this." But she said something that stuck with me forever, something I've mentioned several times on this podcast before. When you hide your voice, you rob the world of your creativity. And I'm not going to let you do it. I ended up sharing with my class, and then I shared it in the district competition, then the state competition, and eventually Washington, D.C. And that project, that changed me. I grew into a creative thinker and a problem solver. And it's ultimately why I became a teacher. And although I didn't realize it at the time, what that was something called project-based learning. Okay, so what exactly is PBL? The thing is, PBL has been around for years, hundreds of years, if not thousands of years. Anytime someone learned through doing a project, that was PBL. And you can see it with, say, Rousseau, for example, who advocated for student-centered learning through, you know, projects. And you really saw it in the U.S. with John Dewey, who advocated for a project-based learning approach well over a century ago. It was a long time ago. At a time when the technology wasn't as awesome and it was harder to actually pull it off. But there were actually a ton of PBL schools that cropped up all around the United States, and they did some pretty cool stuff a long time ago. And there are lots of different current PBL models, but I think the most distinct, the one that a lot of people know, is probably the Buck Institute for Education model. And they identify seven different components: that there's a challenging problem or question, there's sustained inquiry, authenticity, student voice and choice, reflection, critique and revision, and also a public product. And if you check out the blog post that goes with this, you'll see I've done kind of a sketch note sharing those specific design elements as well. Now, note that project-based learning can work in tandem with other pedagogical ideas, ones that we've talked about a lot on this podcast. So things like inquiry-based learning, design thinking, problem-based learning, those types of things. And the key idea, though, is that you're learning through a project. It's not a culminating project. And also that it's a project where students have a great deal of ownership. That ownership piece is significant in having a true, authentic PBL experience. By the way, on this podcast, if you're interested in it, on my blog, it's actually in the Learn category up at the very top menu of my blog. In either location, if you are interested in PBL, you can check out the PBL toolbox that I just finished. It's brand new. It's different. I kind of distilled down a lot of the things I've learned about PBL from doing this for over 10 years. And it's pretty much the things I wish I had known early on when I started the PBL journey. But again, when I first started teaching, I didn't use PBL. So I knew generally what it was. And I had this epic experience as an eighth grader. But there I was as an eighth grade teacher, and I wasn't using it. See, Mrs. Smoot and Mr. Darrow were the reasons I became a teacher. I never forgot that epic experience. And I knew that I was more engaged and I had learned at a deeper level when I learned through a project. But it took me a while to embrace this PBL approach. Don't get me wrong, my students completed projects, but they were always these culminating projects. I chose the end product and reverse engineered them into these detailed step-by-step directions. I set tight parameters. And I wanted them to know exactly what to do. If a student said, "I'm confused," I would assume I'd done something wrong. I didn't see the value in having them own that confusion and solve problems. The point is this: they were following recipes and I was doing all the work. Often on my ride home, I would daydream about doing a true PBL unit, about taking that leap, about making the big risk. But the truth is, it was a big risk for me. I was afraid. What if the students misbehaved? What if they didn't do their work? What if the groups just talked to each other about football instead of actually collaborating? What would my principal think if she walked in and saw chaos? And how could I possibly connect it to the tight standards on the ever-tight curriculum map? So I tucked it away in the someday category. And I didn't do PBL. But then something changed. It was on this lame duck testing week toward the end of the second year of teaching. I had a challenging group of students that included several who were sent in to the team leader, which was me. And I realized that if they couldn't behave when they were done testing, we ought to be doing something different. After a short class discussion, we landed on a documentary project. So eventually we landed on this idea of doing a documentary project about immigration. Students formed small groups and began researching the topic. And what happened next was a mess. I gave many lessons on how to conduct interviews, how to shoot video, how to tell a nonfiction story. I met with students one-on-one to go over how to find more credible sources. We shared scripts back and forth on a shared document. And this little one-week project turned out to be something bigger, with students coming in before school and after school to make something that they were truly interested in. Things didn't go smoothly. A few students didn't finish their parts. We never launched it to a real audience beyond the class, and some of my highest performing students were a little bit frustrated. They had never faced failure. Still, something emerged from this mess. My students were different. Students who had never turned in their work before began voluntarily shooting videos of immigrants in their neighborhood. Students who had never asked questions in class were asking hard-hitting interview questions. Students who had once told me I'm not very creative were setting up storyboards and editing videos. They were making history, literally, by recording interviews, adding their own scripts, finding visuals, and working collaboratively to tell a story. This wasn't a recipe. Each student had created something truly unique. A few students asked me, why can't we learn like this in our regular social studies class? And the short answer was fear. I was terrified of losing control, of having chaos in the classroom and being judged as a troublemaker by my principal. And if you're listening to this right now and thinking to yourself, man, I experienced that fear as well, I would just assure you, on some level, it never completely goes away. Every time you do an epic project, every time you choose to innovate, it's going to be a little bit scary. I worried about the lack of time and resources, but that little tiny project had changed me. And I wanted to teach differently. I wanted to empower my students through project-based learning. So I took the leap. From there, I had students work on a blogging project and later a service project that combined design thinking and service learning. We started painting murals. We filmed documentaries. We did STEM projects. It was pretty cool to see just all the different things they were capable of doing. I found myself perpetually surprised by what my students were capable of accomplishing. And that never happened when I tried to have an entertaining class. That never happened when we did section reviews from a book. That never happened when I had created something engaging but not empowering. Now, a quick confession. It wasn't perfect. I had projects that did totally tank. I had times when I provided too much structure or not enough structure. Times when I didn't give enough scaffolding. Even on my best days with our best projects, I had moments when students checked out and I became that awful nagging teacher that, why aren't you finishing this on time? If you don't get this done, I'm going to have to pull you in after class. Like, I would have to go there sometimes. But despite all the bumps in the road, and there were many, it was worth it because of what the students began to accomplish. So, looking back on it, there were these seven big lies that I believed about project-based learning. When I look back at this PBL journey, I realized that the biggest barrier that I faced wasn't so much external systems and structures as it was my own failure of imagination. I had believed these lies that kept me from truly embracing a PBL approach. So I want to kind of get into these lies right now and why they are lies and not realities. Lie number one, there's no time for it. I hear this one all the time from people who say they would love to do PBL, but there's just no time for it. Projects take time, and for that reason, it can feel like you're adding a new thing to the plate. And the plate's already crowded. There's already things falling off that plate, right? But what if it's not about adding to a plate so much as reorganizing a plate? Once I began implementing PBL, I started to scrap tests and quizzes. I started to have fewer class meetings. I reduced the amount of direct instruction. I layered standards so that students could learn multiple standards at the same time. And the result was something that felt slower, but was actually way more efficient. So that's why it was a lie. There is time in the schedule for PBL. Line number two, the curriculum map is too tight to allow for this. The curriculum map is crowded with tons of standards, and it doesn't seem to square with this need for authentic PBL. But I've learned that there the limitations often create this creative constraint that can lead to breakthroughs. Every barrier you face is a chance to innovate. It's easy to view the curriculum map as a tight set of directions that you have to follow, and yet you have to go exactly where it tells you to go. But what if it's more like a general map showing the destinations you need to reach, but you can actually find the route on your own? In other words, what if it's less like Google Maps and more like a treasure map? Early on in my PBL journey, I started doing an audit of the standards, and I would use the following questions to guide me. Where is there wiggle room? What freedom do we actually have? How can this connect to authentic design experiences? And eventually I realized that certain standards fit well within certain approaches to PBL, inquiry-oriented, choice-oriented, design-oriented, problem-oriented, and in a few weeks we'll be exploring this topic more in depth. But the idea is this. I was able to align the projects to the standards. Okay, line number three. It will get chaotic and crazy. I often hear people describe the need for controlled chaos when doing PBL. One teacher said, you have to be comfortable with a lot of noise and movement, but I'm an introvert. I need spaces of quiet. And chances are my students experience the same thing, or at least some of them. I learned over a decade, throughout this decade of using PBL, that it's okay to have procedures and expectations. It's okay to find ways for introverts to thrive in collaborative projects. I realized that I needed to create ways to guarantee every student participated in collaboration. In other words, you can have a well-managed classroom and also do PBL. All right, fourth lie, kids won't pass the test. Now, the research on this is really mixed. There's no research showing that PBL leads to lower scores, but the research that proves that it increases student achievement is kind of flimsy. But the point is this, it's really hard to prove that PBL will increase student achievement. But I worked in a high-stakes environment, and my students were always toward the top in our district on the state tests. I'm totally sympathetic to teachers on this one. I hate the test, and I hate that you have to have your students pass those tests. I think it's stupid. I hate the pressure that comes along with it. I hate the fact that teachers are being judged by unreliable metrics. I know that they do the best they can. They would bring us coffee and donuts during testing week. And they would be like, hey, it's great. There's coffee in the staff lounge. And you'd be like, hey, why can't it be whiskey? But the point is, despite all of that, my kids always did well. Yes, the fear sucks. The pressure sucks. And we need to work to get rid of those stupid standardized tests. But I never want the fact that those exist to mean we can't have PBL in our schools. I never completely got over that fear and the stress. I never got over the question of the nagging question about whether or not PBL might mean our scores would be lower. But I can say that they always remained high. And I have a hunch it's because the PBL framework led to higher engagement and more buy-in. And even if this test was imperfect, we did well. Line number five, PBL means you don't need any structure. Project-based learning doesn't mean you have to do this free-for-all. The goal is to have structures in place that inspire and facilitate creativity. And these are the structures for things like inquiry, research, ideation, revision, peer feedback, self-assessment, project management, metacognition. All of those things can be structured. In fact, all of those things should be structured. But the best structures inspire rather than limit the creative process. These are all some of the ideas I'll be exploring in this upcoming PBL series that we're doing, and actually on this PBL master course that I'll tell you about in a future podcast. Line number six, you need to have the best high-tech gadgets to pull off a PBL unit. It's true that some of the best projects might have a 3D printer or a really cool studio. But some of the coolest projects I've seen are the ones that are done with duct tape and cardboard. Or I think about my friend Trevor. He's this amazing teacher in Michigan and one of the best PBL teachers on the planet. I'm convinced of it. He did this really cool World War II documentary project, and they actually screened it at a movie theater. They interviewed these World War II soldiers, and they used their smartphones for it. They didn't have the greatest technology. The picture quality wasn't perfect, but that didn't matter. The real power was in the storytelling and in the deeply human connection of having seemingly jaded high schoolers interviewing former World War II soldiers. For what it's worth, I never had a fancy studio or the high-tech maker spaces. But I learned pretty quickly that the most powerful element in PBL is student agency and creativity. Voice and choice will always beat out a 3D printer. Always. Line number 7, you have to wait for permission. I'm not someone who believes it's better to ask forgiveness than permission. I actually think teachers should ask permission. They should share the PBL process with their leaders, and they should talk about how it leads to deeper learning and better skills. It helps to share how the project aligns to the standards, but sometimes teachers will still wait for the permission to come. They'll wait for the principal to come along and say, "Hey guys, we're all trying out PBL at our school." I spent a few years believing this lie. I was waiting for the permission or the encouragement or that perfect moment to crop up, when all I needed to do really was just take the leap and make it happen. So, again, this is the start of a PBL series. I can't wait to dive deeper into it. We're going to be looking at what happens when kids do PBL. We're going to be looking at the different types of PBL processes. We're going to talk about how it can fit within your schedule, how you can fit the standards into it, what you do when you don't have technology, questions around classroom management, how to facilitate it in terms of structure, how you can have better collaboration within your projects. You get the idea. It is going to be a fun, fun podcast series. So the bottom line is this. If you are curious about using project-based learning, check it out. And download the free PBL toolbox, and hopefully you can get started on this PBL journey. All right, thank you for listening to the Creative Classroom Podcast. I really appreciate it. If you enjoy this podcast, would you leave a review on iTunes or Stitcher? And again, go out and make something awesome.